Hey, Dustin, hang on, I'm going to bring Warren in.
Okay. Okay, one more little Warren shout before he comes, folks.
Hello, Warren?
Hello, yes.
There we go. Are we on air right now, Dustin?
You are on air, Warren.
Okay, so...
Welcome to the studio. Just so you two guys know, because just so you can, like, be aware, I just traveled... I was up all night, traveled all day, got here at 10:02 to start the show.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So, I've just been raving about the experience I had at the Commodore Theater with the full power Shambhala warm-up party. And it wasn't a party, it was more like a ceremony slash ritual slash dance-o-rama. So, you'll have to forgive my giddy excitement at times.
That's wonderful. Yeah. But the only people who would have to forgive that are people who are too immature to understand the value of excitement.
Yeah. Oh, it's... it was very powerful.
So Dustin, we're on air with Warren Farrell, and he's a masculinist. I won't say as opposed to a feminist. I think in addition to being a feminist is probably more accurate. He's written several books. The two that I've read are Why Men Are the Way They Are and Why Men Earn More. And you have other books as well. Could you tell us what the titles of those ones are, Warren?
Sure. One is called The Myth of Male Power, and another is called Father and Child Reunion, and another is called Women Can't Hear What Men Don't Say. And The Myth of Male Power is probably the book that has... probably is the most respected of the books that I've written, in the sense that it really looks at what it basically says that men have misdefined power. That is, we have defined power as feeling obligated to earn money that somebody else spends while we die sooner, and that would not be a definition of power that anybody who thought about it would really want to accept, and certainly not one that women would be stupid enough to accept. And but I explained, historically speaking, why neither sex had power and both sexes had roles, and that our parents and grandparents, their attitude was that life is about responsibilities, it's about obligations, it's not about seeking alternatives, it's not about fulfillment, it's not about all the things that in essence they freed us to do and to pursue because they were so preoccupied with survival. And so and then I look at all the, in Myth of Male Power, I look at all the different cultures and why, everything from why women wear veils to why Bibles care more about immortality than they do about morality, and why, what the legal system is about and how it, and where it discriminates against women, where it discriminates against men, and basically understand and explaining why every society that existed and survived had an unconscious investment in the disposability of men, so that men's health was not of concern, an individual man's health was not of concern, because most societies had to figure out a way of getting that man to be willing to risk his life in war or in the military, okay. Or in the workplace.
Can you explain that more? You said that society doesn't have an investment in men's health, and it does have an investment in the disposability of men. Could you give me a couple examples of that?
Sure. War would be one. So another example is the workplace. So for example, all of us live in a home, or most of us live in a home, and that home is built by lumber and by construction workers and by trucker and people, and to get that wood into the home, just let's say the wood for a moment, means a construction worker. Every work day in the United States, 8 construction workers die, hundreds are injured. Truckers are among the most hazardous occupation. Up in Canada, you have the lumberjacks are quite common, and they're among the most hazardous occupations. Canadian fisheries are among the most hazardous occupations. All those occupations are done by men. In the United States, coal mining is quite popular in places like West Virginia, and in every home there is the result of the of this construction of this coal mining, and it's all over our lives, and it costs a lot less to have trained men to think of it as glory or think of it as their obligation to risk their lives in coal mines or as lumberjacks or as truckers or as construction workers if we had to get women to do those jobs for. Our homes would be maybe two or three or four times the price that they are now, because women are not programmed. We haven't socialized women to risk their lives in the workplace. We socialized them to risk their lives in childbirth, but not in the workplace. The same type of thing is true with war. In almost every society that has survived, a significant cadre of men have been trained to think of it as glory. To risk their lives dying and to think of themselves as a hero to die. So in the United States in 9/11, it was the first time that we praised men in decades, and we praised them for risking their lives to die as firefighters or as police officers. And so we give men the bribery of money and praise and medals to risk their lives and to be disposable, because that was healthy for the society to survive, or for the society to have volunteer firefighters to prevent to be able to keep their homes from burning down at a price they didn't have to pay for. But it was not functional for the individual health of the man to be the soldier, to risk death, to be the firefighter, the police officer, the lumberjack, the coal miner, the trucker, or the construction worker.
Is there like a big lineup of women just waiting to get into these jobs that can't? I mean, in some cases, I know that it's hard for women to get into these jobs, but
there is not a lineup of women. No, even when you look at the statistics, like say of construction workers who are women, those are, and you see it's only 2 or 3%. When you really look at people on the construction sites who are actually working, as opposed to people who are working as who are owning construction firms, because in the United States, if you're a female owner of a construction firm, you can get contracts. A certain percentage of contracts have to go to female-owned construction firms, and so many firms are owned in women's names. But if you look at any construction site. The actual work being done on the site. If you look at it, the top of a building on a roof, or to see who's putting the tar paper on, or building the roof, you will almost never see a woman. And women very rarely apply for the position, although there are a few all-female construction-owned firms. I mean, construction firms, but those are few and far between.
I feel like this is kind of like an inroad for us talking about the idea of male power as a myth. I believe that we're all, as human beings, we're all empowered to a certain extent, but I think that what you're talking about here is, do men get their power from the patriarchy? Are we empowered by the patriarchy, or are we unempowered by the patriarchy?
Well, I would start with questioning the very use of the word patriarchy. The word patriarchy sort of has a negative connotation, which sort of suggests that that men have figured out a system to empower themselves at the expense of women and or certain types of men that aren't in the original power class or at the top of the power system. And I would say that there's a lot of validity to the class aspect of that. But what it misses a deeper understanding of what male-female relationships are about. That every society is both a matriarchy and a patriarchy. That is, every society has, and it really is. And the words matriarchy and patriarchy throw off our minds to understand about what the basis of a society was until industrialization, and until, for the most part, after World War II. Most societies were really pretty focused on the issue of how do I survive, and most societies in the world today are still focused on that issue, except for societies like the U.S. and Canada and industrialized nations. So in those societies where survival is the predominant issue, there's the division of labor is usually the mode by which the society survives. and men are dominant, and both sexes are dominant in the area in which they have responsibility. So women were dominant in the home, and a man's home may have been his castle, but practically speaking, the woman was in that home most of the time. She ran the home. She was like a little CEO to her family. And even today, when we look at marriages and we ask, you know, what constitutes a happy marriage or an unhappy marriage, what leads to a divorce, John Gottman and other people who have studied that very carefully find that when a woman is happy, the home is happy, the man is happy, the people are happy. When a woman is unhappy, no one is happy, and especially not the man. And that's what leads, that's the single biggest thing that leads to a divorce. And so in many respects, the woman was in power and in charge. And in other respects, the area outside the home where men had responsibility, the men were in charge. And so I think the division of labor is a less pejorative sort of way of looking at it and a more accurate way of understanding what the dynamic was between men and women for millions of years.
Well, it seems traditionally that we define power by, you know, how are we empowered, say, by laws or by, you know what I mean?
Yes. And that's exactly what I'm sort of questioning, is that the, you know, that laws are a portion of it, but they're also but as the Catholic Church has often said, you know, give me a child for the first 5 years and I will have that child for the rest of my life. And the person that has that child for the first 5 years in most cultures is the female. And what she, the way she protects and handles that child, both male and female, is more powerful than the outside laws. And they're also part of what forms that child, that forms the lawmakers. You know, all these lawmakers are raised by, predominantly by women in most cultures. And so there's what we've called power is just a portion of many types of power, internal power, external power, and they all intersect with each other and overlap with each other.
But it seems to me partially like an illusion too. It's like, you know, and I'm not saying that it's not real, but there's an illusionary element to it, and there's a real element to it. But the illusionary element for me, from what I see when I look at it, is the concept that that, you know, sure, you're empowered a certain amount by society to, you know, and men were empowered to do all kinds of awful things in relationships, really. That's at one point. But at the same time, they were also required to do other things, like go to war and to die and stuff and protect their family with their lives. And I don't know what kind of statistics, I don't think they even had statistics back then, but how many of those men really, you know, took advantage of the law to the full extent and, you know, beat their wives every day? Probably not very many.
No, and everything was, again, that women had permission to beat their children because women were responsible for those children, and there may have been a certain amount of permission for men to hit their wives in some cultures at certain times. But also the flip side of that was that, let's say that the wife went out and spent the family's money to a much greater degree than the family could afford, and the man perceived that as hurting the children's ability to live, and he got upset and they got into an argument and he hit her. But if that family, so that would be, you know, oppressive to the woman in many ways. But if that family did go, did get out of debt, did get into debt, he was the one that went into debtor's prison, not her. So he was responsible for that money. And the same type of thing with if she had sex with a man outside of marriage, that was considered a major violation, and some cultures even allowed him to be justified in hurting her, and in a much smaller percentage of cultures even killing her. But the underlying understanding there is that the person, if a woman had sex outside of marriage, that meant that the man would be supporting economically children that he didn't bear, and eventually that would make him, give him a reason to leave the marriage or never get married to begin with. The society couldn't survive with permission for the woman to have sex outside of the marriage because of the fact that could lead to something that no one could take care of and the society couldn't afford to take care of it. If the man had sex out of marriage, the job of the society was to find him, track him down, and force him to take care of the child.
Really funny because, you know, even just talking about these things, like I can feel myself treading on ground that I know is tender for a lot of people. You know, even talking about hitting and stuff, you know, and all.
Yes, absolutely.
Very tender ground, you know.
Now, the important thing about the hitting issue is that as a result of sort of the deepest way to understand men and women, the most important universal way, is to understand that in every society and almost all animal cultures, animals and human cultures, there's two instincts. One instinct is the instinct on the part of women to seek male protection, and the other is on the part of men to protect women. And so that's instinct number one. Instinct number two is that human beings survive based on their ability to adapt to a changing environment and to a changing world. And at this point in history, the instinct to adapt may very well be in conflict with the instincts for men to protect women and women to protect men, because equal relationships and intimacy in relationships do not come about from women just asking for male protection. Because in order to get that male protection, the man has to be strong enough to protect her. In order to be strong enough to protect her, he has to focus on things that often lead him to be less sensitive and less caring than a person is able to be if they're the person who is protected. Women's ability to be sensitive has occurred and be civilized, more civilized in many respects than men are, as a result of men willing to die to protect women, to be able to be more sensitive, more protected, and more civilized. Now, all that being said, when you look at the statistics on domestic violence, then you get some really fascinating insights, which is that what we've now known for about 30 years in the United States and in most industrialized nations is that in nations where the survival needs are taken care of, in every nation that I have seen studied like that, all the studies of domestic violence that are large enough to be and done well show that men and women hit each other or batter each other either about equally, or that women batter men slightly more often than men batter women. And this is true at every level of violence, from the slap right to the only thing we don't know about is who kills who more, because the statistics in that are men and women kill each other very differently. And the result of women kill men either men kill women either by knives or by guns, and they kill them themselves, and they kill them directly, and they kill them usually when they're exasperated or frustrated or angry or feel that there's no other, they're driven crazy at some level, and they go ahead and they kill their wives. It's usually spontaneously. Women kill their husbands almost only when there's an insurance policy. If they're wealthy, they usually hire somebody professionally. If they're not wealthy, if they're poor, they usually have a boyfriend do it. If the purpose of the female killing the male is to not be able to be caught, to make it appear like an accident, and to be able to get the insurance policy so the woman can live reasonably, comfortably, independently of the man. But those killings, first of all, we don't know how many times a woman kills a man because the purpose of the killing is to not be caught, whereas the man's purpose of the killing is not at all not to be caught. He usually kills himself after he kills his wife. It's usually a murder and a suicide. But secondly, and most importantly, is that the woman does kill the man, and she is caught because she hires somebody else. In the United States, it's the FBI. The FBI does not record it as a woman killing a man. They record it as a multiple offender killing, which goes into a different category. So when you look at the statistics of men killing women 50% more often than women kill men, it completely misses the difference between the way men and women kill and the way those deaths are recorded. But in every other form of violence between men and women and men and women do it equally to each other in heterosexual relationships, and gay women have about the same level of violence as heterosexual men and women.
Let's talk about statistics here for a second. What happens to a man who gets, say, even violently beaten by his wife?
And there are cases I know where men are smaller than women in a relationship together, and the woman is violent. I've read news reports about this. So what happens when that happens? And then he goes to the police station to file a report. What's the common response of the
first of all, it varies from, you know, from police station to police station, and police stations are getting a little bit better now on treating him with some credibility. But as a rule, you know, there are questions asked, like, you know, first of all, in police stations where there's not a lot of education about this, the natural and common response is like, yeah, right, or like, what's wrong with you, or couldn't you defend yourself, or, you know, or level two would be, how tall are you, how tall is she, how big are you, how big is she, you know, are you not stronger than she, that type of thing. But what very few people are aware of is that men are trained to not hit women back. And any man who's being a man in the traditional sense of the word is, if he is, you know, like police officers themselves are often hit because they usually they're not that great at communication. And when there's a back and forth between the woman and the man, the woman hits him and he's got to sort of defend himself, and he might. But he's not allowed to hit her back. A lot of domestic violence against men happens at an older age, when men, because they tend to both die sooner, and men tend to be older than women, when they marry them, tend to get sick sooner. And when a woman is taking care of a man as opposed to being taken care of by a man, she often gets frustrated, and she sees no hope in the future, especially if he looks like he's eventually going to die. And she gets angry and starts oftentimes hitting him, but he is an older man who's sick, has no lifeline except her. And so calling the police is just not a viable option for somebody who is not going to get taken care of as well by an institution as by his wife, and he won't be able to live in his home or whatever. And so there's an enormous amount of domestic violence that happens in older people. But men don't call in and talk about that. There's no shelters for men to call to. There's no hotlines for men to call to. And when they do call the police, they usually get laughed at.
That's a question for me, Emma. Why aren't there men's shelters? You know, there's women's shelters. Women can go. They can express themselves. Even if it's, you know, I mean, I can imagine there's situations where men and women fight a lot. And you know, whose fault it is, who knows. Maybe it's just those two personalities clashing. But then the woman has a place to go.
Absolutely.
Man doesn't, and the statistics that are gathered are all from her perspective.
Precisely.
Gathered at the Women's Center, and they're gathered from her, and the man's perspective does not matter. It is not considered, it's not recorded, and then we come up with these statistics. Well,
and worse than that, we come up with a philosophy of how to handle domestic violence, and that philosophy is usually men are bigger, men are more powerful, men are more likely to do it, men think that they have a right to hit women, and therefore... if a woman does hit a man, this is the result of being on the defensive, not on the offensive. And so once you accept that parameter as the starting block, then when a man and a woman get into a fight, then your job is to get the man to admit that it was his fault before he can even get out of any type of imprisonment situation or any type of therapeutic situation, as opposed to what is the truth, in my opinion, of a domestic violence, which is that domestic violence is a momentary act of power designed to compensate for a deeper experience of powerlessness. So, for example, if you're in a fight with your wife and your wife says to you, you're just a phony and you're just you just do these radio shows to escape your responsibilities to the family, and you say, no, that's not true. I do them, and she interrupts you again, and then you start to explain again, and she distorts what you say and interrupts you again, and that continues happening. Your temper gets greater and greater, and the chances of something happening physically between the two of you is greater. But if, on the other hand, you said, tell me more about that. I'm very concerned about that. It must really upset you that I'm away and not being able to take care of the children and doing these radio shows. And she says, yeah, and it's really infuriating to me, and da da da. I said, oh, I can understand that. You have all these responsibilities with the children and so on. And you continue lying with her and drawing her out and empathizing with what she's going through. The chances of her hitting you are almost zilch. So the point there being that when you empower it, that the way to solve domestic violence is to not have men say, I need to have less power, but rather for each sex to learn how to empower their partner. And the way that you empower your partner is through good listening skills and facilitative skills and empathizing skills. And almost always when you have those skills and you're acting on those, there's no domestic violence. And so the solutions to domestic violence are skipped by people that have a wrong philosophy of it just being male to female, and just being about male power. Domestic violence happens more among poor and uneducated people, not because domestic violence is about power, but exactly because it's about powerlessness. Rape happens much more among poor and uneducated people, and among black males are far more likely to rape. And in all those cases, black males are likely to be poorer, likely to be less educated, likely to be more disadvantaged, likely to be more powerless. And it's the powerless groups that do things that we blame men for doing because of power.
You know, honestly, I'm a member of a kind of like a subculture, I think, that the men that I know are really with their feminine cycle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they tend to be very passive and would be horrified at the thought of hitting their partners. I know that does happen where men do that. You know, maybe out of a powerlessness is what they do. They're trying to exert a power, trying to feel something. And I think that's totally wrong. And I don't know what the statistics are in that. And I just think it's an awful thing, no matter what, however big or however prevalent it is. But amongst the men that I know and that I've talked to, it seems to me more common that from the stories that I've heard, that they get into an argument and it's the woman hitting them and they're not hitting back.
Yeah.
They're being physically, and they have no outlet, they have no one to talk to about it, they can't go anywhere. There's absolutely nothing that they can do about it. They're utterly powerless, and they will continue to be hit and beaten by their women, you know, and maybe not to the point where they're severely injured, but to the point where they are spiritually and emotionally injured.
Absolutely, and it's dysfunctional also for women, for there not to be men's shelters and outreaches for men, because if anything, we should have more outreach centers for men, because men are the ones that are least likely to express their feelings. Secondly, it's not fair for women to have to walk or go and leave the home to a women's shelter. A woman can't say to her husband, if there's a big fight and he's predominantly the one that's furious, to say, spend the night in a shelter, because there's no shelters for him to spend the night in. And so why should she have to leave the home if she feels scared any more than he should have to leave the home if he feels scared? Why should we assume that only she needs help? They both need help. And you know, anytime there's, so we should, you know, we should have really shelters equally for men and for women. We need to have outreach programs for men to say, if you're either in danger of being hit or you're in danger of hitting and losing it, call this number, talk to somebody, get help, and get help before it happens, not just after it happens. And so it's dysfunctional to both sexes. The domestic violence industry is very, one of the most destructive industries in its present form, because there's so much, it's built on anger toward men only, as opposed to being built on learning how to solve the underlying problems of domestic violence.
This is pointing towards something else that just really, you know, I found really struck a strong note with me in your book, Why Men Are the Way They Are, was that the concept that the women cannot be liberated until men are liberated. Could you explain that more?
Sure. Both sexes, you know, whenever either sex wins, both sexes lose, because we're all in it together. You know, the family either makes it together or it sinks together. And so even more so than with African Americans and Caucasians or any class group or race group, you can have Caucasians make it and Jews not, or vice versa. But because they're, you know, while they live in the same society, perhaps, with men and women, there's basically only one purpose for most of, you know, one primary purpose for our lives, which is to partner in order to raise children effectively and you can't raise children effectively by one, you know, a man winning and a woman losing, or vice versa, because both sexes are better parents when both sexes are happy and feeling supported and loved and connected with. And so the real job of all of us is to start teaching communication skills and listening skills at an early age. And what we teach oftentimes, we have debating in school, but debating is basically divorce training. And what we need is, at a very early age, for an entirely different anti-natural method of communication. When I say anti-natural method of communication, what I mean is the natural way of handling criticism is to kill the criticizer before the criticizer kills you. Because genetically and biologically, when we heard criticism, it was potentially criticism from an outside force, which might have been which could potentially be an enemy. So you had to, if you heard criticism about you in your society, you had to prepare your defenses. You had to become defensive, and you had to ideally kill the enemy off before that enemy killed you. And so what we're left with in our individual relationships and our family relationships is this. And when somebody criticizes us, we immediately become defensive, and we try to criticize them, put them down. And that process, which was functional for survival, is 100% dysfunctional for intimacy, because the job of intimacy is to provide a safe environment for somebody's feelings, even if those feelings are critical of you, and to facilitate the person being able to say everything that's in his or her emotions. Things that are true and things that are untrue, things that are said well, things that are said with swear words, things that are not, so the person can discover the full self that is creating all their emotional stuff that's inside of them. And once they're able to be supported to do that, there will be very little anger left in them. And the chances of domestic violence and the chances of two people feeling happily partnered are much greater.
Well, it's funny. It's like I remember some of the statistics that you gave, and I want to mention those. That
in the myth of male power, or why men are the way they are.
Cultures where men and women play very traditional roles, that you see this kind of like this sort of like more sort of traditional female oppression that. And that when men play traditional roles, females are forced to play also traditional roles. And in cultures where men are allowed to play non-traditional roles, women are also more allowed to play non-traditional roles. So there's this kind of symbiotic relationship in our gender roles.
Yes, it's absolutely a dance. I mean, even within a culture, I mean, if you're a traditional woman, you're going to want the man to pick you up. You're going to want him to pay. You're going to want him to seek you out. And the result of that is you walk into a party, and who do you discover? You discover a man who is able to take sexual initiatives because you're not the one taking them yourself. You have to wait for somebody until somebody at the party finds you. But a man who's good at taking sexual initiatives is one that has to deal with a lot of rejection. And it hurts less to be rejected by somebody who's an object than it does to be rejected by a full human being. So the man who's very traditional is going to have to put up a lot of defenses to be able to objectify women. Because he can't handle the sense, he can't do a lot of initiative taking and handle all that rejection and maintain a high level of sensitivity. And so she meets a different type of guy. If she is very traditional and she wants to raise the children full time, she's going to be very much looking for a guy who's a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer or somebody who is a good producer, like a financial investor or so on. And the result of that is that he's going to be learning skills that make him successful at work, which are usually inversely related to skills that make him successful at home. That is, to become successful in the workplace, you have to learn to listen to people, for example, by thinking as they're talking about all the possible things that need to be done. If you're a salesperson is approaching you and you're a CEO, you've got to be thinking, okay, is this the best product or is it not the best product? Is this the best salesperson? Is this, you know, what type of markets do I have for this? What type of advertising do I do? What type of new employment will I have? What are the competitors to this? You're thinking of a dozen things if you're a good executive. But when you come home and you listen to your wife, you listen to your children, if you're thinking of a dozen things, you're a poor husband or a poor father. So the traditional woman tends to marry a man who makes her economically secure, but often does not lead to her being able to be heard, understood, and he doesn't tend to know the nuances of good listening skills.
I can see how this all sort of builds too towards your latest book, and it's very interesting. Like, also just as kind of like an aside, how so much of gender power role stuff plays itself out around food, and specifically, I'm thinking about how here's an example of what you would call the new sexism. You know, the woman insists that the man take his turn doing the dishes. But I've never, ever gone out to dinner with a woman and had her insist that she pay.
Yes, exactly. Or have a man insist that she pay. You know, and or a man say to the, you know, a traditional wife is, you know, we'll often say to the man, you know, gee, you know, I'm sick and tired of doing everything around the house and da 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 da. And so you do the dishes tonight or cook dinner tonight or take care of the, you know, put the children to bed or clean them, you know, clean up or after them or whatever. But you don't hear that same traditional man say, I am sick and tired of earning money. You go to work tomorrow for me.
Yeah.
You do my garbage tomorrow. Pick up all the garbage and maybe break your back or do whatever. I am sick and tired. I'll stay home and take care of the kids. You know, it's the man is considered inadequate if he doesn't share the female function, female role in a traditional relationship. But we never hear the traditional man challenge the woman to take over his role.
Okay, now I know that the quick response to that's going to be, well, men make more, so of course they should pay for dinner.
You mean men make more? They should, of course.
Men make more money, so of course they should pay for dinner.
It's absolutely true that men make more money, but as you know from reading my newest book, Why Men Earn More, is that men earn more money not for the same work. They earn more money for 25 different things that they do in the workplace. So when you hear that, say, for example, that male doctors earn more than female doctors, it sounds like a pretty clear example of discrimination. But the male doctor is far a lot more likely to be a surgeon than the female doctor, a general practitioner, or a psychiatrist. He's more likely to work in private practice. She's more likely to work for an HMO, a health maintenance organization in the United States. He's more likely to work many more hours, have been working more years, have been more, working more recent years. If they're both surgeons, he's more likely to be a cardiac surgeon that has even more specialty and more years of training. It's only when you equalize cardiac surgeons with cardiac surgeons or general practitioner with general practitioner, both in private practice, both working equal numbers of hours, both working for equal numbers of years, that's when you find that the women earn more than the men under those circumstances.
You're not just pulling this stuff out of your butt, right? You've been looking at statistics for years and years.
Yes, I've been looking at census data for 15 years, and the last 3 years, just before Why Men Earn More was published, I've been looking at it for, you know, just examining it and dissecting it and getting raw unpublished data for 3 solid years, and had the help of a Harvard economist for 2 summers to working with me on that.
Founding. You know, something else that I noticed, now I liked that book because what you're saying there, and it's not like just saying, look, you know, men deserve to earn more. That's not what you're saying. You're saying, you know,
oh my God, nope. In fact, the opposite of that. If men earn 1 penny more than women do for the dollar, or vice versa, which is true of women, I mean, women do earn more money than men for the same work when everything is controlled for. And it's because we, in this culture at this time, basically unwittingly, we value women more than men. But also there's a supply and demand for women that's greater than for men. If an engineering firm has more men than women, which it usually does, any given woman who's a graduate in engineering from a school that applies to a firm, she's a rarer commodity. People have to pay more for her. There's affirmative action that requires certain percentages of women to be hired in order to get federal contracts. And then, if there's a gender discrimination suit against the firm, then the firm is in a much better position if it has more women. It doesn't. So I think any given woman is paid more than a man for the same number of years of work and so on. It's only as a man puts in more years, takes fewer leave of absence, works in portions of, say, engineering that pay more, the subfields that pay more because they're more technical or fewer people want them. Want to work in those fields, that's when men start getting paid more than women do.
Right, you know, it was really cool what you said about, too, how a lot of the jobs that that women do that are in the same fields but are different. Like, for example, the cardiac surgeon versus the GP, there's a reward that is non-monetary that women are getting, which is the personal satisfaction that you can get from a job that doesn't make as much money. And there's a reason why those jobs pay less, and it's because you're getting more of a personal return. You're getting something that's...
Absolutely. And so, for example, most men and women, when they work hard, they have families. And men work a lot less when they don't have families. As a matter of fact, men work so much less when they don't have families that when you have women who have never had children and you compare them with men who have never had children and have never been married, the women who have never been married and never have children, they earn 117% of what the women do. And the reason for that is that men who have never been married and never had children tend to take more fulfilling jobs, like in the arts, social sciences, for example. Women who have never been married and never have children, they take jobs that are more like men's decisions, they more in technology and science and so on. They tend to travel more. They tend to work harder, work longer hours in the workplace. Women who are married and have families, they work more in the home place. But the women who are but if you compare two executives, a male executive on the average will earn more than a female executive. It's only when you look at which ones travel more, which ones are executives for national or international corporations. So the male executive, comparing the male executives, the female executive is comparing apples to oranges. The male executive is more likely to do more traveling, more work in finances, and so on.
I just wanted to get clear on that one point because I was kind of a little confused there. But you were saying that women who are single and don't have a family generally earn more than men who are single and don't have a family?
Yes, the exact statistic is women who have never been married, because a woman can be single but have been married, and she's in a different category, because if she's had a family and now is single, like a single mother, then she earns less. But if she's never been married and never had children, she tends to put more focus on her career and make career-type decisions, like she'll go into the math or sciences, more similar to men's decisions. Conversely, a man who's never been married and never had children tends to make decisions in the workplace that are more like women's traditional decisions. He's more likely to, say, be an artist or a social scientist, and he's likely to work fewer hours per week. And so the sum total of his 25 decisions and hers lead to her making more money than he does. The precise figure is 117% of what he makes.
It really seems like, in a way, when you look at it this way, men are kind of getting the short end of the stick, right? Where we feel like we have to provide for our families, so we work super hard. We don't take very fulfilling jobs, things that are good for us. We end up taking more dangerous, more stressful jobs. As a result, we end up dying sooner. And at the same time, we have this whole thing that women are then empowered to, you know, through culture and society, empowered with government programs to get into jobs that are sometimes more difficult for men to get into.
Absolutely, it's we're living in a very tough time for guys at this moment, because you know, the normal trade-off was that, you know, that women and men did their traditional roles. They both got a, if they did them well, they got appreciated for it. A woman who was a good mother and had 8 or 9 children was appreciated for that. And she lived off of her appreciation. But more recently, like, you know, in the United States, when soldiers came back from Vietnam, they were spit upon. And when men these days do if they earn a great deal of money, we say they're part of the patriarchy. They're powerful. They're in control. They're dominant. They're in a male-dominated profession. They're oppressors. And if they don't earn money, they're invisible. No woman wants them. They're lazy. They're unemployed. And so the man feels oftentimes caught between a rock and a hard place. And if he's working in a job that's very technical, we often think of him as disconnected, a nerd. If he's high up on the corporate ladder, he's oftentimes preoccupied with his work. If, on the other hand, he doesn't make much money and he's an artist or a social scientist and he's, as an artist, you know, he's oftentimes unable to get work or to make much money. And, you know, so we don't respect him for the lack of money that he has. He's not considered an eligible father and so on. So it's really, when he's very young, he learns that sex is dirty. But on the other hand, he's expected to be the one to initiate the dirt. And if he does it too quickly, he's considered a date rapist. If he doesn't do it quickly enough, he's a wimp. So if he gets to be 18 and there's a war, a brew, he's the one that's expected. In the United States, every male at the age of 18 has to register for the draft. And if he doesn't do that, he goes to prison. He gets $250,000 fine. He's never allowed to work for another for a government agency in his life. And so, he has to make some important decisions about, you know, is he willing to kill or is he not willing to kill? And he has to make those decisions when he's for all intents and purposes between 17 and a half and 18, and decide whether he's going to be put in prison or not, or, you know, or be willing to kill if he's needed.
Well, it's mind-boggling, really. Like, and I don't want to downplay either the whole thing with the psychological barrier for women who feel like, you know, disempowered by a culture that makes them feel like they have to play a role that is traditional, and then the frustration that must come from that for them. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. In the traditional roles worked very well for some women and some men, and just didn't work for the personalities of other women and other men. And the downside, the great blessing of the feminist movement is that it encouraged women who were not traditional to feel. It gave women who were not traditional social and emotional and psychological support to feel good about themselves. You know, a woman who was a scientist, good at science, when I was growing up, the most she could expect to be was a science teacher. No one encouraged her to be a Nobel Prize winner or, you know, move to that type of level. And so the women's movement has been a great blessing for expanding the options of women. The difficulty is that nobody's done the same equivalent for men. And the bad news of the women's movement is that it has demonized men and made men the enemy, as opposed to and thought that men had the power. And the misconception there is that, as I said at the outset of our program, that historically speaking, our grandparents and our grandmother and our grandfather, neither of them had power. They both had responsibilities. They both had roles. They both had obligations. And roles are not about power. Roles are about the exact opposite of power. They're about being told what to do, not being empowered to decide what to do.
Warren, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing this with us. Hey, can I ask just one more thing? What can men and women do right now? What's the number one thing that we can do to liberate ourselves and liberate each other?
Well, for men, it's really about learning about who you are. And, you know, when I wrote a book called Father and Child Reunion, one of the things that I focused on in that book is what fathers do with their children that leads to children who are exposed to dads being so much more effective and capable and healthy psychologically, emotionally, socially, and physically than children who have less exposure to father. But no father knows what he does, and so therefore he can't explain it to women, and women can't hear what men don't say. So I would really say the first thing that a man can do is start doing homework. And he can, you know, if he wishes to start with one of my books, then go to my website, warrenferrell.com. There are summaries of those books there. The Farrell is F-A-R-R-E-L-L .com. And just go to the, you know, just check out which books are good for you. And if something is not good for you, send it to me and I'll give you your money back for it. And you can use the bibliographies of those books to go to other books by different authors. And for women, you've probably read some books on relationships. And therefore you've read things from the female point of view, because publishers cannot afford to publish things from the male point of view because men don't buy these books. And so start reading some things that explain, if you care about men and you care about intimacy and you care about your son growing up to be understood by you, then read some things from his perspective, and that will allow the man in your life to feel understood and cared for and loved by you. And that creates the basis for the greatest gift that any human being can have, is the gift of, you know, feeling able to love the people in your family.
Thanks again for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for being on the show, Warren.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Okay. You're a fantastic interviewer, by the way. Ask good questions, and you've done your homework, and you listen really carefully, and it's really been a real pleasure to be interviewed by you.
Yeah, and thanks for all your books. They really opened my mind to a lot of new possibilities.
Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Bye. Dan, you still there?
Yeah, bro.
Hey, brother.
That was good, eh?
Was he talking about you being a good interviewer or me?
I think it was you.
Okay, good.
That was pretty fun, eh?
Whoa.
Like, just a whole different perspective.
Yeah, I know. I'm like,